From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Now that the dust has settled from the first Democratic Party's presidential candidate debate for the 2020 election, it appears that the field of frontrunners has somewhat reorganized. Media pundits have labeled California Senator Kamala Harris as the clear winner over both days, while Senator Elizabeth Warren held firm to her policy wonk status. Former Vice President Joe Biden appears to have faced the greatest damage to his candidacy. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg managed to hold his own and has proven his fundraising chops in the aftermath. Former San Antonio, Texas Mayor Julian Castro surprised many with his progressive positions. And former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke and Senator Cory Booker embarrassed themselves by breaking into Spanish. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who has been credited with moving the party leftward, came under criticism for repeating himself. My guest is Arun Gupta, an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Nation, Salon, Raw Story, and The Intercept. His forthcoming book is called Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. He's a regular news correspondent for our program. Welcome back, Arun.
Great to be with you today, Sonali.
So the debates last week, there were so many candidates, they had to spread them out over 2 days. And I don't know, I guess by freak of coincidence, the only sort of serious front runner in the first day one of debates was Elizabeth Warren. And she seemed to also garner a lot of time, speaking time during the debates. Essentially, people criticized her for not sort of moving the needle forward. She stuck to her talking points. How do you assess Warren's performance at the debates?
So I think the question is, what do we expect from these debates? You know, that's a thing. Or what do the media tell us that we should expect from the debates? That they're a form of political entertainment? Are these supposed to be serious discussions of policy and what is really the problems facing America, the crises facing the world? And it's what people are looking for are fireworks. Who's going to get in the best dig? Who's going to make a gaffe? And honestly, I don't think that these are going to have that big of an impact once the primary season starts. You know, at most, it's going to winnow out some of these people who nobody knows any idea who they are. I mean, I still can't tell who half a dozen of these white guys running are. They all look alike to me. You know, and so the thing is, I think, you know, Elizabeth Warren did fine. You know, there wasn't like, you weren't like excited. You know, this, it's often called a beauty contest, right? So yeah, Kamala Harris, the second night, she certainly had the best speaking style, had the most energy, was animated. But is that what we're looking for in a president? Someone who can essentially be an actor? Or are we looking for someone who's representing policies and the 10 or 11th out of appointees that come in with them that's going to run this massive enterprise called the U.S. state and try and change people's lives for the better instead of trying to change them for the worse?
I do want to dig into Kamala Harris's performance, if you will, and I feel like performance is the sort of appropriate word on when discussing these debates a little bit later, and especially the exchange between her and Joe Biden. But staying on day one of the debates, Warren, as I mentioned, sort of stuck to her talking points and reiterated them. And she sort of almost shown this slow and steady wins the race type of attitude where she's doing what she does best, which is come up with these pretty serious policy platforms. And then you had someone like Julian Castro, who especially on immigration has been extremely progressive and actually, I thought, emerged fairly strong. But then you had the sort of embarrassing Spanish battle between Cory Booker and Beto O'Rourke. I thought they embarrassed themselves trying to do it in the format of a debate where you have very little time to make your case, and both of them, you know, are not native Spanish speakers and sort of struggled through it. So any thoughts on those candidates?
Well, you know, I thought it was funny with Beto that one of the times that he spoke in English and then in Spanish, I can't remember exactly what the question was, but he was ducking it, he was dodging it, and I commented to someone next to me, so he's going to dissemble in two languages. That's his response. In terms of you know, I think one good moment the first night was when Julian Castro showed him to just kind of be a doofus on immigration policy, that he didn't even realize some of the important intricacies in terms of criminalization at the border. And I thought it was also interesting because I've been talking to all sorts of immigration activists and organizers the last couple of weeks. Someone commented in a large group that the Democrats have pushed the needle to the left of many of the frontline immigration organizations, in that they're calling for decriminalization of border crossing, and that's what part of the battle between Beto and Julian Castro was over.
Right.
And
Now, go ahead.
that's just going to say, in terms of Booker, he's the candidate for Wall Street. He's the guy who attacked Obama, a Democrat, for being too easy on Wall Street, even though not one executive from a big bank was prosecuted. That's all you need to know about that guy.
So in terms of the scope of the debate, I'm wondering what you make of the format and the issues that were discussed. I mean, the issue of immigration came up because it's so much in the news. Iran came up briefly. Climate change came up, but very, very briefly. I think Media Matters for America did an assessment and pointed out how just a very tiny number of minutes during the entire debate was actually spent on this really critical issue. Healthcare came up in a fairly serious way, but could it have been broader, or are we just sort of hamstrung by the format?
Well, you know, there could be all sorts of different formats. I mean, there's no reason that the debate couldn't be for 2 hours or so. You know, these are for-profit companies, but these are the public airwaves at the same time. And this is the problem where the FCC does not mandate that these telecommunication companies should be, you know, first of all, the fairness doctrine, which was done away with during the Reagan administration. They should be devoting more time to political education in a balanced manner. Otherwise, you just get these kind of moments where everyone is looking to score the big point, and, you know, like embarrass the front runner the way that happened the second night. In you know, and then yeah, the questions in and of themselves, some of them were just terrible. In terms of climate change, you know, like asking, "Can you save Miami?" which shows a fundamental misunderstanding of the effects of climate change to think that Miami can be saved, or asking questions about who pays for mitigation for climate change.
Right, the framing of those questions were very sort of pro-corporate and not, pro-planet.
Yeah, and it's just like this is the reality. We're all paying for climate change. We're all going to pay for climate change, and it's should also be pretty simple. You know, it's just like those who cause the problem should be paying for it.
So then, night two of the debates had several heavy hitters stacked in one on that second day with Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg, and then you had some of the sort of unknowns like Andrew Yang and Marianne Williamson. But the Biden-Harris exchange was the centerpiece of both nights of the debate, and of course, certainly what Harris showed was that she's a very, very good orator. I mean, she is a prosecutor. That was what she did for a number of years. And it seemed, however, even though it was such a powerful exchange where she accused him of not supporting integration and busing, a few days later, her website was selling T-shirts of Kamala Harris's picture as a young girl, saying, "I was that little girl." And she was accused of, kind of ruining the moment and exploiting this whole exchange as if it was all planned and contrived, and not the spontaneous, riff.
Well, I think it was certainly planned. You know, multiple times she told the story about being the little girl, the second class to integrate a school in her region. So she was planning to do that clearly, and it also recalls a little bit Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election during the debates, where Donald Trump called her a nasty woman, and within 24 hours, seemingly, her website was selling nasty women mugs and T-shirts. That moment was interesting, and I think it continues to resonate because it is very revealing about what has the Democratic Party stood for and what our society stands for. And I think, you know, you don't see this real commitment to integration. Now, if you look at federal data, America is slowly getting more and more integrated in terms of neighborhoods, but schools are still profoundly segregated, and most African Americans still live in highly segregated, low-income areas. And we as a society do not have a plan for economic, social, racial integration. That seems to be a project that has given up on.
Now, it seems as though that exchange revealed more about Biden's shortcomings than anything else, right? He very clearly represents the old guard of the Democratic Party that paid lip service to racial justice, but ended up dallying with segregationists or just sweeping it under the rug. And he seems to have not gotten the memo about not just where the party is today, but where the country is today.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to defend him, but I think the thing that we have to recognize is that liberalism is not all about racial progress and solidarity at the same time. I think you want to see expose a liberal's racism. The quickest way to do it is tell them that their kid has to go to a school that's 50% black. And so I think there are lots of Democrats who are not going to admit that they also have prejudices, and that, you know, if you tell them that your kid is going to go to a black school, well, they're going to think, well, you know, it's like I want the best for my kid. And, the school's not going to have the resources. There's going to be problems. You look at some place like Seattle, one of the most liberal cities in the country, a huge proportion of white parents send their kids to private schools. I think it's something like half of them do. So what you have is a school system that I believe has an overrepresentation of students of color by more than 2-to-1 than the general population. So the public schools have become kind of this dumping ground for low-income students of color in a lot of areas. So this is a really significant issue. And there is also, I think, an easier way to deal with it, which is to have just complete equity in terms of school funding. And yet we see extraordinary disparity from county to county, district to district, even school to school within the same district, where you see wildly different funding, and that is flowing to higher income, whiter schools.
Do you feel that as a result of this debate, Joe Biden has been bruised enough that he may not recover? I mean, he seems out of touch. He's lost some major fundraiser, some major donors, and he has, I think, really been put in his place.
Well, I mean, you know, the idea that Biden was ever going to be the front runner just shows the complete bankruptcy of the liberal media. The guy is a walking political landmine.
So you feel that he was the front runner only because the debates hadn't begun?
I feel he was the front runner only because the liberal media appointed him the front runner. Everybody knew about his creepy groping issue with women and young girls. Everyone knew that he voted for the Iraq War. Everyone knew that he sat in the vice president's office while Obama was deporting more than 2 million immigrants. He has a terrible record in the way that Hillary Clinton had a terrible record for decades. There's the Anita Hill stuff, there's the mass incarceration, it just over and over. And then of course he is just prone to saying stupid stuff all the time,
right? And he continues to defend his defense of segregationist lawmakers even after the debates.
Yeah. And he had, you know, as others have pointed out, he had over 40 years to come up with a good answer, and he still hasn't.
So what about some of the other candidates? Pete Buttigieg, the South Bend, Indiana mayor, and you know, there were reports on Monday that he has surpassed sort of fundraising records, which is supposedly a measure of his popularity. And he's sort of been painted as somebody who can effectively take on Trump, as is Kamala Harris, right? Because a lot of these, the discussion around the candidacies is less about what can this person actually do as president for the country and more about can they beat Trump?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been reporting on presidential elections a long time now, and I've reluctantly come to the conclusion that this is essentially a product launch. This starts in many ways with Nixon. There's a famous book in 68 called The Selling of the President, which was the first time where you have really modern mass communications advertising techniques used in the election, along with TV and also just kind of complete manipulation of the media. And we've seen it get worse and worse now for over 50 years. So it's a question of what product captures the public's imagination, the way that George W. Bush did in 2000, the way Obama did in 2008, the way that Trump did in 2016. And I don't see any of them having at this point what it takes to beat Trump. Now, Trump is wildly unpopular. He's just relying on a shrinking base, but we also know he's going to pull out all the stops to try and steal the election. Nothing is beyond this guy. And I've said it before, and I say it again, I wouldn't put it past him to encourage his followers to show up at the polls in November of 2020 with guns to keep the illegals and Mexicans from voting. He will pursue just the most illegal criminal methods you can imagine. And the only way to defeat him, I think, is to have someone who really just sets the public on fire the way Obama did in 2008.
Well, what about Bernie Sanders then? I know that you have shown support for his candidacy this time around, but even though, as I mentioned earlier, he's been credited with being the person who's pushing the party to the left and was the front runner before Biden showed up, then became the second in place, the debate essentially didn't he didn't shine during the debates because he was saying what he's been saying for many, many years. On the one hand, you have to admire the guy for sticking to his guns. On the other hand, is that setting the public on fire? Not quite, right?
Right. And that's what I was getting at, essentially, that, you know, yes, I'm not going to I do support Bernie Sanders. That doesn't make me any less objective. In fact, you know, anyone can look at my reporting to see that I called the what was going on in 2016 nearly better than any other reporter out there. And there were thousands of reporters covering that election. But at the same time, when I look back at my coverage of 2016, I was not paying enough attention to what the reality was telling me in terms of how Trump was just whipping up this white nationalist fervor behind him. And, you know, we couldn't believe what we were seeing. So with Bernie Sanders, And again, it's not that I don't like it, but he does seem like yesterday's product. And the question is, can he capture the public imagination like he did in 2016? I think he would make the best president. I think he is absolutely right that you need a movement. That is an absolutely crucial point that sets him apart from Warren in a big way, that you're only going to get these changes when there's a huge movement from below. But is this just like yesterday's cold leftover soup?
It feels as though a lot of the candidates who have adopted positions similar to his, such as Medicare for All, etc., are understanding that that's where a lot of the public is, at least Democratic voters and progressives. But if you look objectively at many of these candidates, none of them can really be trusted to actually carry out these positions and platforms once in power. We can perhaps only really trust a President Bernie Sanders or possibly a President Elizabeth Warren, who have shown consistently that these are positions that they have taken from the start, that these are principled positions that they actually truly believe and not, are coming late to the party. I mean, Pete Buttigieg may say something's nice, Kamala Harris may talk about healthcare, but we can't really trust any of them because they're late to the game.
Oh yeah, or they just have like terrible ideas. Buttigieg said he would, put he would expand the Supreme Court to 15, and there'd be five Democrats, five Republicans, and five independents. And he just wants to go back to this fantasy, like Biden does, of civility that, we'll all just get along instead of recognizing that we actually now have a genuine fascistic president. We're still in the early, very early stages of fascism. But, when we have concentration camps on the border, when he's threatening ethnic cleansing, when we have a Muslim ban, and when we have criminalization of women's reproductive health care, these are all components of a fascist ideology. And you're not going to put this genie back in the bottle. Fascism has to be crushed.
So, speaking of concentration camps, let's talk about the issue that Trump has made it very clear is his main campaign platform in 2016 and clearly in 2020 as well, which is let's demonize the immigrants and whip up the white supremacists who are afraid of of becoming a minority and losing power, and let's win election in that manner. This whole idea of where we are today around immigration is pretty shocking. I mean, I think even you and I a few years ago might have been hard pressed to imagine the situation we're in with not just overcrowding of these detention centers, but the fact that we're imprisoning children and absolutely, just torturing them in the most deplorable conditions that you cannot refer to in any other terms other than concentration camps. So we are here in this moment, and I know there's been a lot of activism around this issue that you're also engaged in. Tell us a little bit about the work you're doing a lot around calling attention to these detention centers and labeling them concentration camps.
Yeah, so I'm working with a group of amazing organizers and campaigners. I really some of the smartest people in the country to put out a national call to create a mass mobilization to shut down the concentration camps through peaceful, compassionate, militant protest activities, strikes, blockades, marches, vigils, sit-ins, whatever it takes, we have to try and shut down these camps because we are at just an absolute perilous crossroads in this country. Trump is a coward, and you put up enough resistance, and he does move his attention elsewhere. As for instance, it's been reported that he's basically lost interest in Venezuela because there was no qu a quick coup there. And yes, it is true that immigration is going to be his number one issue. But part of the reason is because the Democrats keep being terrible on this issue. The way they completely botched this bill last week, and basically passed the McConnell bill that's going to keep funding the torture of these children. I'm actually not really that surprised, you know, because in 2016, I towards the end of his campaign, I wrote an article that Make America Great Again is ethnic cleansing, that that is Trump's agenda, explaining that that, you know, was what he was going to do. And I was called, you know, like, oh, you're being like alarmist and hyperbolic. But the evidence was there for if people wanted to see it. So what we're hoping is to try and spark some sort of mass movement in the style of like Occupy Wall Street or Standing Rock or Black Lives Matter. We're putting together an infrastructure, mainly digital right now, a Facebook page, no more concentration camps, website, nomoreconcentrationcamps.com. That's going to go live this week. You know, there's a huge amount of energy. There's also protests coming up July 2nd by Move On that you can find all around the country. July 12th, there's this Lights for Liberty. You can also find protests against the camps around the country. And I will add one thing about camps. I've been talking to various rabbis. I've talked to four rabbis since last week, and all of them agree that concentration camps is an appropriate term.
And in fact, on Monday, we reported during our headlines that the group Never, there's a grouping called Never Again, that
Never Again.
In Elizabeth, New Jersey, blocked an ICE detention center.
Sure.
And there were about 36 arrests, and they're predominantly Jewish activists, literally saying, we know what we're talking about, and we will never again let this happen. A pretty powerful symbolism there. I know there've also been people of Japanese ancestry, and even some survivors of the Japanese internment camps that have been speaking about this as well, right?
Right. Actor George Takei, who from Star Trek, who was in a concentration camp during World War II, says these are concentration camps as well. But, you know, it's I think we've started to move past that debate, that there is widespread agreement. I think, you know, it's important to recognize and acknowledge the historical trauma suffered by the Jewish community. But if that phrase never again is to have any meaning, we can't say that, you know, you can't use the term concentration camp, because if the Holocaust is completely unique, singular in human history, then never again doesn't mean anything.
And in fact, I believe it was the Holocaust Memorial Museum that rejected Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's statements that detention centers are concentration camps. And a lot of people have pushed back, as you've said, on that, saying that that's not true.
And you know, we have to remember that a lot of the people pushing back, certainly not the Holocaust Museum, but a lot of the pushback from the right comes from people who support concentration camps, come from people who supported the massive slaughter in Iraq and the archipelago of gulags that was set up there, such as Liz Cheney. She was one of the ones pushing back against AOC, and her dad, Dick Cheney, is responsible for this global gulag of torture facilities for killing a million plus people in Iraq alone. These people do not have humanity's sake at heart, and they also don't have the Jewish community's sake at heart. This is a president who embraces anti-Semites, who calls neo-Nazis very fine people, who tweets out anti-Semitic memes. You know, they don't care about the Jewish community.
Right. Well, Arun, we'll link to your effort, No More Concentration Camps, from our website. Good luck with that. And thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Nation, Salon, Raw Story, and The Intercept. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. He's a regular news correspondent for our program. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for a daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.